The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
There is a lot of sorrow in the world. How are we to hold it? There is a lot of beauty and joy in the world, too. How do we hold that? We've been living in a house that's on fire as long as we've been on two legs. So that capacity is been passed down from our earliest ancestors. But having capacity without skill means much of that capacity is never fully utilized. This koan this morning, I hope, addresses that. This is from the Book of Equanimity. Jujur's one finger, the pointer. 1,000 awakenings at one hearing, at one understanding, 1,000 follow. The highest people comprehend all with one determination. The middling and lesser hear much, but disbelieve much. Let's try and bring out the direct, simple point, the main case. Whenever Master Jujur was asked a question, he would just raise one finger. Hongzhu's verse. Old Jujur's fingertip, Chan. 30 years he used it without wearing it out. Truly, he has the unconventional technique of a person of the way. Ultimately, there are no mundane things before your eyes to see. His realization, most simple. The device, the more broad. An ocean of billions of worlds is drunk in the tip of a hair. Fish and dragons, limitless. Into whose hands do they fall? Take care, Mr. Wren, holding the fishing pole. This weekend we've been doing an introductory retreat, an introduction to Zen practice, with some of you who have been joining us from home. And so we've been talking about the Eightfold Path and the Eight Gates. We've been talking about different forms of practice, giving instruction, asking questions. This is all very important. It does belong to the realm of thoughts and meaning. We are talking about something. And so it said that Bodhidharma taught that our tradition is a special transmission outside scriptures, beyond the reliance of words and letters, a direct pointing in the realization of enlightenment, to see directly, to experience beyond knowing. There's teachings and instruction that gives instruction, that directs, that points, that lays things out so that we can understand. And part of that is to help us cultivate faith. Part of it is to help us cultivate understanding, to have skill, develop skills, so we can practice carefully. But there are other kinds of teachings. As he says in the pointer, let's try and bring out the direct and simple point. That's the function of Atesha. It's the function of much of the teachings that exist within the history of Buddhism, certainly within the Zen tradition. Often when you encounter a teaching that you don't know what to do with, It's pointing to the direct and simple point. It's not giving you instruction. It's presenting the enlightened mind, the enlightened view. It's speaking to that mind that we each possess. It's trying to speak to it directly. In a poem by Hong Zhu, the Chinese master Hong Zhu, called The Lancet of Seated Meditation, in that poem he says, it knows without touching things. It illumines without facing objects. Knowing without touching things, its knowledge is inherently subtle. Illumining without facing objects, its illumination is inherently mysterious. And I think what happens in the course of Buddhism coming forth is that as it reaches out and to respond to the need, to respond to people's interest and questions, and to all of the various places from which people are coming from, and particularly within our culture, in our time, which has little patience, a seemingly, perhaps a kind of diminishing appreciation for what is subtle, that there's a danger of, in trying to respond to the need, of, in a certain sense, making the Dharma more and more accessible. And what do we mean by that? So there's the positive and necessary aspect about that, which is actually making it possible to discover the teachings, to go to a place where teachings are occurring, to help people get there, to make sure the finances are not a burden, to make it a welcoming place where they arrive, so that people arriving from different places and different bodies can actually walk in and encounter the Dharma without a lot of obstacles in the way. That's all good and important. There's another way of making it accessible, which is, in a certain way, runs the risk of diminishing its light, making it more understandable in such a way that initially there's a kind of satisfaction and appreciation because there's something that's more immediately received. I get it. I can use this. I understand this. And there is a value in that. But the value really should be to sort of help us to stand up on our legs a little bit more strongly so that then we can engage a more direct and simple point, which is not going to be accessible in that way. It's just not. Because that accessibility that we know and yearn for is really coming from what we already know. It's sort of like a string that is vibrating in one vibration finds resonance with strings that are vibrating in similar wavelengths. And that can make a beautiful sound. But here we're trying to actually leap free of that sound that we've been immersed in our whole lives. To know without touching, to illuminate without facing. Its knowledge is inherently subtle. Its illumination is mysterious. Which means that will only appeal, it won't appeal to everybody. It won't speak to everyone. It won't speak to almost everyone at certain points. Otherwise, everybody would know. When our mind touches things through our senses, we imprint our mind on it. And we look for things that are familiar right? That's what our mind does. Is it's eager to put whatever we're experiencing into categories that already exist, right? Because in that there's a sense of of knowing, of security, of familiarity, of not being at risk, not being threatened, and knowing what to do. We're on familiar ground. And that's why Buddhist practice is fundamentally disruptive. Disruptive of that aspect of the familiar, which is just entrenching. But for that to happen, there has to be a degree of willingness and receptiveness within us that is seeking that, even though we will recoil. That resists it, even though there's something within us that is walking in that direction. When our mind imprints itself on something, it does that very tangibly with the names, with ideas, with associations, with beliefs, with memories. Oh, this is like that. Oh, you look like... I know somebody who has that name. We all do that. There's no inherent harm in that. It's a way of relating. But it's also a way of filing. And in that, there's a subtle... Until we see it, there's a subtle workings that is going on in which that we are seeing and imprinting our mind on is becoming more and more of an object. Which means less and less of a living thing, a dynamic, moment by moment thing. And in that objectification, it begins to exist apart from ourselves. And as it more and more exists apart from ourselves, we see it less and less. And more what we're seeing is our mind. Now, this is just what our conditioned mind does. It's, in a sense, no one's fault. But it has a lot of impact. To know directly without touching, without interacting, without distorting, to illuminate something that is before us. There is something there. What is it? What is the nature of it? Because it's subtle, it's easily missed. Although nothing is hidden, much is not seen. And in our distractedness and all of those mental formations and imprints, what is revealed in every moment becomes concealed. And in that, we will perceive that something is missing. We see something, but somehow something is missing. It's just not enough. And that missing something, I think, shows up as our sadness, our sorrow, our anxiety, our anger, our blame. So how do we study this? How do we turn towards the fundamental? So every day, at any time when a student would ask Master Zhuzhi a question, he would just raise one finger. His dates are not really known. He lived somewhere around the 9th century. He was several generations past Ma Zhu, so the great Master Ma Zhu. So he was in the Linji line. And this was his teaching. As he said, he used it all his life. So how do we study the reality before our eyes? Given that it's already abundant, it's ever present. In that sense, there's nothing to be done. And even that being so, something seems lacking. And so we practice. Because it reaches everywhere, it is unconfined, undefined by boundaries and characteristics. Free of everything that could constrain it or confine it, it is then free to show up as anything. We say that very, very succinctly in the Heart Sutra: form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Why is this important? Why is it important to study phenomena? You know, we can understand why it's important to realize, maybe we can understand why it's important to realize the selflessness of the self, right? That our thoughts and emotions are empty and have any intrinsic characteristic quality. They are not permanent. That there is no essential self existing apart. We begin to appreciate how attachments always have to be based in that sense of something apart. Otherwise, there's no way that we could even have the urge to attach to something. And we see how that causes us so much distress. So that sort of makes sense, to liberate the self of life and death from within life and death. But what about phenomena? Why does that matter? That we understand the nature of things. Well, we live in a world of things. That seems pretty clear. We navigate them all the time, negotiate them, right? And given that our mind can turn pretty much anything into a thing, and then we are in relationship to that, or are we? What are we actually in relationship to in that moment? Is it that object? Is it my mind? Where is that happening? And then thoughts arise. I have impulses, desires. I speak them. I act on them. You experience them. And so throughout, there are so many teachings where one teacher raises a finger. Yun Man points to a sesame cake. Someone holds up a staff or a stick. How are we to understand this world? What is this world? How does it come into being? And the commentary says, Vimalakirti said, a hair engulfs the ocean. According to the Surangama Sutra, a single hair tip can contain the lands of all 10 directions. There are many teachings that point like this, and not even just in Buddhism. The pointer says 1,000 awakenings at one hearing. In Master Dogen's teachings of the 10 directions, he says a single fist, just this, is the 10 directions. Why the concern with phenomena? And what is the relationship between a thing and the vast and boundless universe? The 10 directions means literally north, northeast, east, southeast, south, southwest, west, northwest. Up, down, everywhere. All directions. The 10 directions means the whole direction. You know, when we look at suffering, wherever it appears, in all of its many forms, one of the characteristics of that is always confinement, constriction, tension. Not just a gathering in, but a binding in. That something that may be alive is made more and more inert, is dampened, is deadened. Something that may be very large is made smaller and smaller and smaller. And when we trace that back to its source, we find the source is a human mind. And that that mind has those very same qualities. I mean, just think about it. We all have those moments where we are in a heightened state of some strong emotion, feeling, and the tightness of that, the constriction of that. You know, what is it when somebody's sitting here doing nothing on the cushion in the seat of the Buddha and you want to break out of your body and skin, right? That there's so much energy that is bound that we just want to, it's like we're going to explode. What's going on? And that all of the ways of describing our basic nature, the nature of things, the nature of life and death, the nature of objects, is always in the realm of expansiveness, spaciousness, boundlessness, vastness. How many ways can we say it? And so just sort of, you know, sort of looking at the evidence. So what is happening there? That our actual embodied experience, when we are sort of living within dukkha, living within our attachments, within our false views, and that the actual response that we experience within ourselves is that and that when in those moments of release, letting go, relaxation, all pointing in the same direction, that there is always an experience of that. So what is that showing us? Dogen says a single fist, one fist, just this, is the 10 directions. Its nature is that. You know, these teachings, when I talk about, the challenge of using language. So what kind of language do we use to try and point to the essential, to the ultimate, to the fundamental, because we want to get to that fundamental and not just be dealing with things on the surface. Because when we deal with things on the surface, we have to do that forever. Nothing is ever resolved, really. Nothing is ever conclusive. It's just mitigation. It's just like taking care of it in this moment, but it's then we're just waiting for the next moment. So we're trying to get to the root. It's like when you're trying to, you know, transplant a tree. If it's young, if it's just a little sprout, it's just, you know, the roots don't go very deep. You just scoop it up. But if it's a big, mighty tree, you have to dig really, really deep and go very broad, because those roots are deep and broad. And by the time each of us comes into practice, we're pretty much of a big, mighty tree. And so how do we do that? What kind of language do we use? How do we point to it? So in Buddhism, we talk about upaya, skillful means. Skillfulness in the sense of that, how. Skillfulness that does what? It helps to, in a sense, startle us. Like we have to, something has to get our attention. You know, so we're just sort of walking along, meandering along, taking care of business, doing what we've done, and then something gets our attention. It might be a tragedy. It might be something terrible. It might be something very subtle, but it gets our attention. And in that attention, it gets our attention in a new way, because in that the getting of attention, something is raised, a question, a wondering, a reflection. Something is starting to happen. And so part of the function of upaya is to startle us, to begin to shake us loose. Part of the function of that more direct pointing, that direct teaching, is to actually instill doubt. Now, usually when people think of doubt, they think of self-doubt, insecurity, not feeling capable or worthy. That's generally not what Buddhism is talking about. That's a whole thing that we have to practice very carefully and well. But doubt in Buddhism is doubting samsara. It's doubting the story. And so the teachings are intended to instill doubt, to sort of shake us loose of our arrogance or a sense of false certainty, to instill a sense of faith or help us cultivate faith where there might be cynicism or hopelessness, to bring forth a sense of urgency where there might be complacency or indifference, a kind of, I'll get to it tomorrow. I'm going to live it forever after all, aren't I? They're intended to get under your skin. You know, if we only encounter teachings that just make us feel good, something's not happening. If we're only encountering teachings that are affirming what we already know, we're not being startled yet. And Dogen is a master of this. I was going to say a love-hate relationship. Hate is a little bit too strong. But it was more in the what is up with you spectrum of things. Like, I understood it wasn't going to be easy, but really? The 10 directions, Dogen says, the 10 directions enter one direction and enter one Buddha. A single fist, just one, is the 10 directions. The 10 directions enter one direction and enter one Buddha. This being so, the 10 directions appear in the 10 directions. Because the 10 directions are one direction, this direction, self-direction, present direction, and the 10 directions are the eyeball direction, the fist direction, the bare pillar direction, and the lantern direction. The 10 directions, Buddhas in the 10 direction land, are neither large nor small, neither stained nor pure. He is talking expressly about how do we live in this world within our fundamental vastness, boundlessness of Buddha nature, showing up in a world of things, of objects, of people. And he's saying it in a way that is calling us in. Zhuzhir would just raise a finger. And the footnote to that says, why expend so much energy? What is he saying? From the beginning, there is Buddha nature. From that perspective, all of this is the expenditure of way, way too much energy. But because it remains hidden, seems to be hidden, effort is called for. What is this one finger? Another koan master holds up a staff and he says, if you call this a stick, then you are committed to the name. You're tethered to the name. If you say it's not a stick, this does not exist, then you deny its presence. What will you call it? And this is iterated over and over and over in the Dharma teachings. And sometimes adding to that is, if you say it's both a stick and not a stick, or it's neither a stick or not a stick. In other words, trying to deal with all of the conceptual possibilities and cutting all of those off and saying, no, no, no. And even if, does that really satisfy? Does that free anything, adhering to any of those views? And in a sense, what we have to do as practitioners is see in that the immediacy, the intimacy, the urgency, the you of that. That teaching is not, there's nothing abstract about it. There's nothing remote. These teachers, all the way back to the Buddha, are talking about us. They're not interested in wasting time. Not interested in theoretical word play. Well, then why don't they just say it directly? What if they are? What if they are, in fact, saying it directly? For us to hear it directly, our mind needs to become attuned, direct. If we attach to the name, because of the relationship in our mind with language, it's not just a name, it's not just a word that we attribute to something. Think of all that comes rushing in with that name. Think of when you think of a parent or a friend or somebody who calls out your name in this particular way or in this particular way. Bonnie Sue, come here right now. It brings in with it worlds. But if we deny its existence, all things are empty. Nothing exists. This has never been a Buddhist teaching. This is delusion. Just a different form of delusion. It's to deny that something is in front of us. But so if we don't build our nest in one side or the other, then what is this? When we don't attach to anything, what is this? And if we can study this, something in which there's not so much history, maybe, so much emotion. Maybe we can study this a little bit more calmly. And then in seeing into the nature of that, we realize, oh, all things. Then when that finger is a thought, is an emotion, is a sensation, is a memory, is a state, is that different? Emptiness appears as form based on causes and conditions. It's the same nature. To understand that all things arise in dependence. In order to experience an object, this, there has to be this, your eyes, and your consciousness. So that means this doesn't just exist in the world for any of us. It only exists when we see it. And in that moment of perceiving, when our consciousness perceives it, what if our consciousness is prejudiced, is biased, is laden with historical baggage, is immediately searching for categories to put this in? Is anxiously wanting to define it, to understand it, so we can dispense with it. Then, what is the relationship we have with this? And what if this is a person? Because it is. The Buddha said life is dukkha, the first noble truth. That doesn't mean that inherent within life there is suffering. The Buddha realized there is nothing inherent in anything. There's no self-existing, independently existing, autonomously existing thing in anything. Life as dukkha means that we have a profound inclination, proclivity, penchant for creating dukkha within life. It arises from our desire, from our grasping. Beneath all of that, though, is our understanding. And understanding here is not just our active, conscious knowledge. You know, if you ask me, how do I understand something? And I explain my understanding back to you. That's one aspect. But the much deeper aspect is the understanding that I'm not even aware of. Isn't even conscious to me yet. That is so deeply integrated through so many moments and months and years and decades of repeated experiences. An understanding that's permeating our being. And so to get to that root, we have to start interrupting the cycle. Disruption. Startling. We have to learn to bring what is, seems to be constantly in motion into a natural state of rest. The body, the mind, emotions. So the Chinese master Churi said we have to stop and see. See things not as they appear, when they appear, but as they are. To see without naming, without touching, without reacting, without denying. And in that, what will become constricted and confined if we follow along that habitual path remains open. And isn't that a wonder? Where something that seems so taut and so constricted, and then just with not mind control, but by actually releasing the control of the mind, that offending object no longer offends in the same way. It's not the same. What's going on? Are we curious? I remember sitting in this very hall the first time I really engaged it deeply in such a way that pain in a moment was not what it was a moment ago. And I stopped and I went, wait a minute. Because I thought, was I just sort of manipulating and trying to control that? Was it kind of, you know, aggressive mind control? And I thought, no, that isn't what's happening here. That's what I was doing a few moments before and trying to stop it. But something much more spacious, much more relaxed, actually, is happening. And I haven't moved. What is going on? What is this object that seems so definitive, so absolute, so inarguable? Inarguably itself. Ow! One master said, the true nature of phenomena, suchness, has no beginning, middle, or end. This state of infinite evenness, equal to space and pure by nature, has no beginning or end. It is beyond any time frame. It is unborn, unceasing, and has no substance or characteristics. It neither comes nor goes and cannot be characterized as some thing. It involves no effort or achievement or anything needing to be done. The ground of suchness itself has no periphery or center, since it is non-referential and uninterrupted. It is the expanse of equalness. It's the Heart Sutra. When we come into practice and we try and express what it is that we're experiencing and what's causing us distress and pain and suffering and confusion, We're talking about things inside and outside. But what we're really talking about is our relationship to it. What we're really talking about is your mind. What we're really talking about is the nature of the self. And the path kind of takes us on that trail in and seeing more and more clearly the root of the matter. A metaphor is that when you lift up one corner of a quilt, the whole quilt raises up. You know, it's important to understand that practice is not linear. You know, as we start to practice and we see all the things that are, you know, there, you know, our attachments, our desires, the things, our habit patterns and so on, and we can think of it like, you know, a warehouse that's got this like infinite number of objects, and we're going to have to go through every one and like deal with every one, right? And some are going to, you know, you can just toss away very easily. Some you're going to have to get on the ground and wrestle with, right? And you look at this warehouse and think, oh my God, I'm ever going to do this. It'll take forever, right? It's not like that. It's not linear. It's more like you walk in and there's just one thing in the middle of the floor. It's just one thing. But it's resilient, right? It seems to spring back. It seems to return. It seems to morph into a different form, right? Like an actor, like a chameleon, like clever, clever little demon thing. And it's just our mind and everything. And to see the, I mean, even to see the connection is already too far away. To see it as one thing. Then we begin to appreciate that when this arises and we practice this, which is such an important principle in practice, don't put it off. Because when we put it off, it doesn't go anywhere. It just takes up more space and energy, right? Because it needs to be attended to, so attend to it. And when we practice that one thing, that reaches out. Or you could just say it reaches in because it's just one thing. It's not linear. Zhuzhe says, he was getting ready to die. And he said, I attained the one-finger chan of his teacher. And I've used it all my life without exhausting it. And then he died. And the question is, why didn't he exhaust it? Why couldn't he exhaust it? And when students are working on this koan, they come up with all kinds, and I count myself in that, they come up with all kinds of very clever responses. Why he could not exhaust this one finger. But we're really not here to be clever. And it's so easy to find intellectual answers because the intellect is so strong and powerful, and that store is always open, right? Its shelves are always full. We can turn to our conceptual mind, and you can always pull something off the shelf, right? And it seems like it's free, right? Not quite. And so, in a way, part of our discipline is to be developing a deep trust in that non-thinking mind so that we can really understand and be at peace with our thinking mind. It is not a demon. It is not the enemy. Old Zhuzhe's fingertip chan, 30 years he used it without wearing it out. The footnote says, even up to now, his disturbing hand is indiscriminately applied. Does that mean that we're using it all the time, but we don't know? Does that mean that masters throughout all of Buddha Dharma have been using it freely without discriminating? Ultimately, there are no mundane things before the eyes to see. He ends with, "Take care, Mr. Wren," holding the fishing pole. This is an old story about a man who every day would go out to fish, and he would put on his hook, I think 50 cows, big hook, throw it into the ocean and fish. And day after day after day, he pulled up nothing. And then one day he pulled up a huge, huge fish and fed the whole countryside. Practice can seem like that. How to be skillful. How to be skillful within our own practice. To be learning how to be skillful. Master Dogen says, it reaches into the 10 directions, and we need to hear that over and over again so that from within our own experience, it seems narrowing and confining to remember this is just my perception of this moment. It's just my perception. That's all. And that what these teachers have said in one voice over and over in 100,000 different ways is in that very same moment, it is so large, you cannot contain it. It is not bound. And so this sense of returning home to that. At the end of Master Dogen's Lancet of Seated Meditation poem, he said, "The water is clear right through the earth. A fish goes along like a fish. The sky is vast, straight into the heavens. A bird flies just like a bird." Within that vast boundlessness, a fish goes along just like a fish. A bird flies just like a fly. You walk just like a person. You sit just like a Buddha. We eat just like a Bodhisattva. It is always revealed. And we just need to reclaim our capacity to see directly. Zhuzhir holds up a finger. We don't have to wait. Everywhere, something is being held up. And to trust that your Zazen, no matter how you find it, no matter where you think you are in it, and don't be so sure about that either. Placing ourselves somewhere along the path. To keep remembering it is here. It is here. It is not hidden. Not so that we try and force some experience, but so that rather we relax that tendency to try and make something happen. It's already happened. And so to be able to, in a sense, cultivate and then effortlessly bring forward that mind so awake, so bright, so clear, so trusting, it sees. Those of you who are with us for the weekend are really on behalf of all of us. Express our appreciation for your having joined us. Hope that it was helpful to you. Hope that we see some of you. I hope we see all of you again. I'll be bold. But more importantly, that you continue, because each of you came here, and all of you who are here this week, this Sunday morning, and all of us who are here because we brought ourselves here. Something is going on inside. We should respect that, honor that, tend to that. If we don't, who will? So please, raise one finger and ask. Ask.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.